A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome back to Candidate Confessional. I'm Sam Stein.
And I'm Jason Cherkis.
Jason, I want to talk to you a little bit about this Washington Post piece that was published in 2009. It's an odd little item on Michael Steele and his use of rap slang. So, hear this. At the time, Steele is chair of the Republican National Committee and is far and away the best known African-American Republican in the country.
And at the time, he made a series of remarks where he dropped phrases like bling bling and slum love. And he may, as the Post reported in gritty detail, referenced public enemy's time bomb.
Which is just a natural thing for a politician to do. No, it's not. So the mockery worked for a reason, mainly because the Republican Party has this terrible time attracting African-American voters, and the concept, the idea that you can just do it by dropping a Wu-Tang reference is, it's preposterous.
But the mocking also suggests maybe we are still a little bit uncomfortable with the concept of a black Republican.
Yes, exactly. And for instance, the Washington Post reporter who applied the Urban Dictionary to Steele, that guy was a middle-aged white man.
And we should point out that we are two white guys.
Well, yes, but I'm not middle-aged.
Either am I.
No, you are. So when Steele came into the studio, we asked him about all of this, and we did it through the lens of his failed 2006 bid for the United States Senate, which featured, among other things, some particularly nasty moments involving race.
And at the end, we had to play him some Key and Peele.
Beyond the bluster.
Behind the bunting.
Past the posters.
After the ads.
The campaign picks up.
And the motorcade moves on.
What happens when the votes are counted?
And democracy doesn't go your way.
This is Candidate Confessional, a HuffPost podcast.
I'm Sam Stein. I'm sorry.
Actually, I'm Sam Stein.
And I'm Jason Cherkis.
And we approve this podcast. So this is a podcast about people who've run for office and who have lost.
Oh, great. You don't want to be also, this is some form of cathartic kind of reliving my worst moments in politics.
Actually, that's precisely why we did
Where's the box of tissues?
Oh, yeah.
I just want to tell you, I hate voters.
So 2006, let's start there, and we'll actually move back to 2002 eventually.
Okay.
I think what you guys were saying when I entered was that had you not run in 2006, you'd be a senator.
Yeah, that's a very clear point. And I hear it not just anecdotally, but when you look at the numbers before and after that cycle, 2006 was just an incredibly poisonous year for Republicans. The brand had sunk to a new low. The White House was scrambling, dealing with the war in Iraq. It was dealing with internal pressures at home on the economy, which
Katrina
was beginning.
Too.
Then there was Katrina, which was a whole nother can of worms, which really created some tensions between me and some of the folks in the West Wing, because I did not want to carry that water on Katrina the way they wanted it carried at the time. And as you recall, there were a number of candidates who were also running for the U.S. Senate or governor or some other offices who were distancing themselves from the White House.
Sure.
I didn't. I was a fan then. I'm a fan now of George Bush and his presidency. And, I have issues with a number of policies and things that they did.
Yeah.
But the man himself, I had an immense amount of respect for.
Toxic climate.
But it was, But I was going to say, the underlying root of everything was very poisonous.
So then why the fuck did you run?
Aside getting a phone call from the president and the vice president, You know, I'm the sitting lieutenant governor of my state, and I think we've done a very good job. And I have to be honest with you, it was a very, very hard decision to make. It meant coming off of the ticket with Bob Ehrlich, who I thought, and I think everyone would agree, was a very, very good governor for Maryland. But even his campaign suffered as a consequence of the poison that was out there about Republicans. Bob and I talk about this to this day. If I'd stayed on the ticket and we'd run as a unit, you know, we probably could have beat back some of that. But when we split, yeah, it's sort of the divide and conquer thing. We got conquered by the wall of ugly that was out there.
But, you know, you're a young man.
Yeah.
What are you, 35? 40?
I love this podcast.
It's a good podcast.
I look 35, nothing else.
You certainly had to think in your mind, okay, this is—
Oh, there really were moments saying, what the hell are you doing? And why are you putting up with this shit from these people? Who are these people? I mean, I did a lot of, you know, Seinfeld impressions at the time because there were moments.
You want to give us one?
Yeah. Who are these people?
And what did Bush and Cheney—
What
did Bush and Cheney say to you to get you in the race?
We need you to run. It was very
basically that.
They appeal to that sense of service and the opportunity. I mean, there are a number of things that kind of converge in a moment like that. There's the politics. Okay, there's an open U.S. Senate seat, and I've been a fairly successful lieutenant governor. You know, pretty well regarded in the state, known nationally. I mean, I was been involved in the party. I was a county chairman, state chairman. It was. Someone that had roots around the country working with other political leaders in the party. So it wasn't like, oh, gee, there's the black guy. Let's go ask him to run. So there was none of that because I just don't play that game. But, I know and had a relationship with the Bush family. The president's sister lives in Maryland, and I've gotten to know her over the years. And certainly Jeb, I gotten to know and do some things with in my official capacity and in personal capacity. So I kind of had a relationship with the family. So, you know, when the president calls, you take the call.
You do. I'm joking. Of course you do.
You take the call.
You don't put him on hold?
Okay. You don't put him on hold. And you listen. You listen carefully. And you appreciate the fact that the president thinks enough of you to ask you to do this. And so that weighs in heavily. Then you have to, of course, weigh that against your spouse, who has a slightly different opinion, more aligns. What are you, crazy?
What was her opinion?
What are you, crazy?
The calls came, like, the day Sarbanes announced he was retiring.
Yes! And think about it. I really didn't get into the race until almost 7 or 8 months later, because yeah. I didn't want to fall into the trap, first off, of being, you know— the figurehead, you know, oh, let's put him out there and let's run the race. I'm like, no, okay, I want support. I want money. I want infrastructure. I want a clear deck because I can't waste resources in a primary in a fight that, you know, with that doesn't go anywhere. And so you handicap yourself coming into the general election. So, you know, I got the Rule 11 letter from the party where they said, all right, you're going to be our guy. We're going to get behind you. And from the White House to the party leadership, to the governor's office, to, you know, the counties and everybody, we were all of the mind that we can do this.
The fact that Bush and Cheney both called you up and encouraged you to run, I mean, that sort of presaged the problems that you're going to have, which is you ended up having to do fundraisers. Not having to do. You ended up doing fundraisers with Bush, with Cheney.
Didn't mind it at all.
That
didn't hurt. You know,
I'm not saying it hurt,
right,
but it certainly was complicated. Because
it was complicated.
Not exactly well-loved figures in Maryland.
But, you know, it was less complicated on the war stuff and more complicated on the Katrina stuff.
For the last 4 days, I've been seeing dead bodies in the streets here in Mississippi, and to listen to politicians thanking each other and complimenting each other, you know, I got to tell you, there are a lot of people here who are very upset.
Because, again, I live in a black community, so that was of paramount importance, not to mention I had family and friends who were affected by it. I thought the president had been ill-served, and I said so publicly at the time, which really rubbed Karl Rove the wrong way. But I didn't give a rat's ass about it because at the end of the day, as I said to Carl, when I go into a Starbucks in my neighborhood, I look in front of me and behind me and I see black folks. Who do you see?
Yeah.
Who do you go home and see in your neighborhood? I've got to deal with the people in my neighborhood. So I've got to be first authentic and true to myself. And the second, I've got to be there and honest for them.
But were there debates in going into those fundraisers, for instance, about, oh, maybe we shouldn't do this because we're going to get some really bad headlines? We're going to be tied to this administration that's
going to there were folks who were squeamish about Dick Cheney coming in and doing a fundraiser and the president coming and doing a fundraiser. You remember at the time, there were a lot of Republicans who were like, no, Mr. President, you know, we don't need you to come.
We might be busy
Mr. Keene up in New Jersey is like, you don't need to come up here. That's all right. We don't need you up here. And certainly a lot of the blue state Republicans were running away from the White House. I was like, that is not honest, number one. It's not authentic. I mean, I was a supporter of the president. I went around the country for him in 1994. How do I now, 18 months later, sit there and go, dude, don't come into my backyard? So I had to be honest about that, and I was. And, you know, there were some folks who were nervous, but I'm like, if the vice president and the president wants to do a fundraiser for me, hello. Set the time, the date, the place, and we get it done. And we did. Was there some negative press from it? Yeah, there was negative press, but it didn't reverberate negatively with the voters, because at the end of the day, it's some Democrats even said to me, "You got balls for at least." you're standing next to your guy. We got to respect that.
And you raised some good money too.
Oh, I raised more than the Democrat did.
Yeah.
In 2002, when I ran for lieutenant governor, there were a number of instances of racism, outright racism by Democrats in the state that went unreported, unacknowledged, and really, I would say, accepted by the press, who didn't cover. We would tell them, look at this, and they were like, oh, that's just politics. I'm like, that's bullshit.
What were some of the
instances? So for example, there were ads that were done that showed me in blackface. Now, as a black man, putting me in blackface is, you know, with big red lips and the sort of Al Jolson mammy hands.
Yeah.
That bullshit. And then you had the moment when during the debate, after the debate that we had, we're all standing around in the auditorium afterwards, and I looked down at my feet, and someone had tossed or rolled Oreo cookies, meaning, oh, black on the outside, white on the inside, at me. And I'm like, what the hell is this bullshit, you know? And so you had those types of things. In my neighborhood, signs went up in the last 2 to 3 weeks along the road. Just, you could drive up Central Avenue, 214, and there would be signs that would say stuff like, remember who's on your side. Black ain't enough. And stuff like that. So what I told my team to do was like, okay, screw it. Let's do this and have fun. So we had a 6'4", because that's my height, cardboard cutout of me posted at every polling place in Baltimore and Prince George's County. So when you walked in, we wanted you to know who Michael Steele was, even though you knew I was a lieutenant governor. But you had to find a way to push back and to show that you're not affected by that. You have a problem with my blackness? Well, let me show you how black I am. Mm-hmm. And so you have to figure out a way to go around it or deal with it. But, yeah, you had all of these little vignettes that would unfold during the course of the campaign, whether it was, you know, Mike Miller, Senate president, referring to me as an Uncle Tom, with impunity. Now, it was like the words ran trippingly off his tongue, and people were like, oh, okay, reporters writing this shit down. I'm listening.
How do you spell uncles with the one U?
With the one U, is it a C-L-E or is it C-E-L? You know, it's – and you're sitting there going, really?
So you've had this episode in 2002 where it's pretty bad.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously you're not going to duck away from doing this again, but certainly that must have weighed on your mind when you decided to enter an even higher profile campaign.
You know, I have to tell you honestly, I come at this from a very different space. I spent a number of years in a monastery before I got into politics, yeah. full blown. And so my psyche, my orientation is rooted somewhere else. And so I don't, there's a lot of stuff that bothers me, but how I handle it and how I deal with it is going back to that space that I once occupied in my heart and my mind. And it helps me kind of deal with and put into perspective the crazy that's in front of me.
Well, how did it bleed into the 2006 campaign? Because there was so much fascination. And it wasn't just you. I mean, Lynn Swann was running up in
Lynn Swann, and then you
had right, Blackwell in Ohio.
In Ohio, right.
So there was this whole—
Oh, did you see the article that came out? I think it was a Cosmopolitan article that they took it down fairly quickly once we really brought out who had referred to Ken Blackwell, Lynn Swann, and myself— Two of us running for the U.S. Senate.
Two running for governor.
For governor and me running for the U.S. Senate as the lawn jockeys of the Republican Party.
There did seem to be stories every week addressing race, and you were called out. You're not addressing it enough. You're not addressing it too much. It's like
so. Take us inside the.
Well, yeah.
Of the
well, you can't be black when you're a candidate, and we've seen this play out with Barack Obama. And I think he's taken the short way out, which is not to deal with the issue of race at all, effectively, except for when he really has to. And you can't be seen talking about black issues. Because all of a sudden now, oh my God, you know, then all you care about are black people. Like, well, yeah, I'm black, so I guess that helps. you can't. But then again, if you don't say enough, then you have black folks pissed off at you, mostly black liberal Democrats who bought into a system that's failed the community, and we can have that conversation. Who sit there and they scream at you about who you have on your staff. That was that. You know, it's like what I told the campaign was, look. These are things that we're going to have to deal with. Who's on our staff? Who isn't on our staff? Because I had to deal with that as lieutenant governor. You know, I had a black chief of staff, and everyone threw a hissy fit. Didn't know how to deal with the brother. I'm like, dude, he's a political operative like everybody else. He's the chief of staff. Just deal with him. Mm-hmm. But that was a problem. You have, you know, in the campaign environment itself, you know, well. You have no blacks on your staff. Well, okay, that's probably true. You know why? Because the party's never taken the time to actually groom blacks to be political operatives, to be campaign managers, political directors, communication directors, finance directors. So when I have to go as a candidate into a statewide campaign, or even I'm running for local sheriff, what pool of talent am I going to pull from? I'm going to pull from the established talent that has been developed by the white infrastructure, which is largely white males, not even females, except for money, because, you know, we can have that conversation about why they solely focus on women in that regard. But at the end of the day, you're looking at a system in which you have to try to figure out how to work.
Were they trying to make you talk and act and be
yes.
more of a white
yes.
candidate?
Yes.
How so? What were they tell you?
Well, they were just like, well, it wouldn't be like you need to sound white, but it would be like, well, you can't say that. When I was at the RNC, I actually had a member say to me, you know what your problem is? I was like, what? I have many, but tell me. you sound too black.
Shut up.
Hand to God. When I write the book, baby, trust me.
Oh, my God.
What'd you
Trust
say to the
me.
Guy?
Wait, what'd you say?
It was a woman.
Okay. We like, you have you noticed
and
that?
And I just looked and I said, I was like, well, this is just what I am. This is how we talk where I'm from.
Jesus.
I mean, yes.
You took off your gang colors.
Yes. This is what I have to deal with. This is my life
so
in miniature.
When the DS accessed your credit card information, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being really pissed off, 1 being mild, where were you?
Really pissed off.
Yeah?
Really pissed off.
Quick time out here to explain exactly what it is we're talking about. So, back in the 2006 elections, a staffer with a Democratic senatorial campaign committee illegally obtained Steele's Social Security number and then used it to access his credit reports. It was a big deal, and it kind of rocked the campaign for a bit. All right, back to the show.
Because it was a violation of everything that we profess, particularly in a campaign setting, it violated all the bounds and the limits that, you know, everyone likes to get up to, but they don't cross. But probably more than anything else, what pissed me off was how the press didn't respond to it. They just didn't. They took it as part of, well, you're a Republican. What do you expect?
I liked how the DS fired two very junior people.
Thank you.
For somehow going rogue in acting.
Right. I'm like, wait a minute. This was up here at the top, but this wasn't something two little rogue guys, girls sitting in a corner lab somewhere. Like, oh, gee, let's go and set up this phony dummy account. But it was just the lack of response, the lack of pursuit to truth, and the lack of holding Schumer and his operation accountable for what they did, but particularly in the face of how people were responding to any slight, perceived or otherwise, towards Barack Obama at the time.
But did you, at that point, were you like, holy shit, this is like, this shit just got real? Like, I thought.
Oh, no, it was real long before that. Okay. No, that it did. Put it this way, as angry as I was, it didn't surprise me.
Okay.
I wasn't surprised by this happening. I was just, if I was surprised by anything, I was like, what took you so long? I thought we would have to deal with this shit a long time ago. I mean,
it did seem like, you know, once a week or every other week, you would say something or show up something that sort of shocked the establishment. You showed up at, I think, at a Congressional Black Caucus fundraiser, which sort of ruffled people. What was that like when you walked?
Well, A, I was invited. So these are colleagues in some cases, friends in other cases. And it was an interesting moment because there were a lot of members of the caucus who came up to me to express their appreciation for what I'd been doing on reforming small business enterprise for black folks in the state. Pushing the envelope on some education things, criminal justice, looking at reforming our juvenile justice system, particularly Eager Street Academy in Baltimore City at the time. And I knew these folks. They knew me. I was not a stranger. And this is what I've always said to party people. Don't be a stranger to the people you're talking to.
Yeah.
You know, you sit there and you, oh, we want the black vote. Well, damn it, go get off your ass and go get it. And that means showing up and being in a space that sometimes makes you uncomfortable. And that's what I believed in doing, being uncomfortable. So when I got the invitation, I went. And it made a whole lot of people very uncomfortable. And I'm like, deal with it.
There's a theme sort of developing in this campaign, which is there's one sort of contentious moment followed by another contentious moment. And it just seemed like it was building.
Welcome to Steel World.
And well, there was the country club comment where Ehrlich could.
Ellington Country Club, or was it? Where it was a whites-only country club. And
that who? That I went to?
No.
No,
no, I don't think you would get in.
Thank you. I was going to say.
Ehrlich played.
Where Ehrlich played.
And then you said, I don't care about it.
I didn't care about it because I think at the end of the day.
So I don't play golf.
I don't play golf. So what the hell? Why would I be upset about where he plays golf? But what does that say? I mean, look, but
You've never played golf?
I have played golf, but I don't play it well. Let me just make this point on this,
sure,
because I think it's important about race. We fixate on the unimportant stuff.
Yeah.
And we blow it up to the point where it's supposed to mean something when, in fact, it means nothing. And that was my point, was when I'm looking at a public school system in which black kids are treated not as second-class citizens but not as citizens at all because they don't have the resources, they don't have the teachers, they don't have the infrastructure they need to support them, I find that to be more racially offensive than where the governor plays golf. So I was trying to bring clarity and perspective. And a lot of times in this world, this space that both of us occupy together, media and political— we lose sight of that, and we want to chase the rabbit down the hole of, well, what's your reaction to the governor playing at an all-white country course, golf club? I'm like, well, they still have those? Okay. Oh, if they do, then okay, how did he do? But now can we talk about the fact that in this community, blacks could not even get transportation to that country club to protest the fact that it's still all-white?
I'm wondering if there were white Republicans that saw you and were skeptical of you or didn't trust you because of your race.
They would never say it. You never get that sort of overt sort of response. But let me tell you what my test was. I'm very sensitive to race for a whole lot of reasons, because I think it's something we don't deal with in this country. We don't know how to deal with. We don't want to deal with it. We kind of dance around it. So going into the 06 campaign, one of our first polls, I said to my team, I said, can I put a question on the ballot? I said, in fact, I have two, and I need them to run back to back. And they're like, okay, what? I said, the first question is, would you vote for an African-American for the United States Senate? And the second question is, would your neighbor vote for an African-American for the United States Senate? First question came back 74% yes. Second question came back 43% yes.
So you're trying to measure the so-called Bradley effect.
Right. So the reality is that number, that second number.
Yeah, not the first.
Not the first. Take the 06 election with me and Kwesi and Fumi on the Democrat side, me on the Republican. Take the 2014 election with Brown, Lieutenant Governor Brown, mm-hmm. running as a Democrat, and Larry Hogan. So here you have in two moments, two opportunities to make history as a state.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Send a black man to the Senate, nominate Kwesi and Fumi, and he and I talked about this. What a race it would
be. For the listeners, Kwesi Fumi was
the former head of the NAACP, and he was a candidate for the United States Senate.
Who lost to Ben Cardin
mm-hmm. in the Democratic primary, which is close to 40% black. Kwesi and I would talk about the fact the goal for our respective campaigns is for both of us to win, to be in the general, because that way we knew there would be an African-American going to the United States Senate. And when he lost his primary, that to me said a lot.
So I want to the reason I want to sort of make this more, or I'm trying to hit on a theme, which is that there's a lot of controversial things going on. You enter the race, you raise a lot of money. It's
right.
a close race.
Yep.
We're going from controversy to controversy. You put out this ad, the infamous or famous, because it's not infamous, the puppy ad.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us the story of the puppy ad.
Puppy ad is
from the origins to its publication.
Okay, so the origins of the puppy ad was we had done an ad before. And the Democrats had kind of, you know, gone after me, and they'd started to come after me on a whole bunch of stuff. And I was sitting around a table like this with my team, and we were talking, and I'm listening to all these folks, and I told them, I said, look, guys, I can't do red, white, and blue. I'm not a red, white, and blue Republican. I'm sorry. You cannot do an ad with me sitting in front of some friggin' picket fence with the flag flying over my head and this sick-ass music playing underneath. I said, that's...
As you walk through
a cornfield. Or a cotton field or whatever the frig you want me to walk through. That's not... I come from the hood. I come from 8th Street, Petworth. It's a whole different... So I need to keep it real. All right. So that's one. Two... You and I know, because it already started this, I think this was after the Schumer thing, and they're already starting to come after me. And I was like, look, you and I know that they're going to come after me, and they're going to say, you know, I'm the worst thing ever since, you know, since God created man. They're only going to say, I hate puppies. They're going to say it. So the next day, I come into the office, and the guy brought in his puppy. He said, we're going to make an ad. I was like, okay, let's talk about that. So we talked it through, and I said, great, let's do it. And at the time, I remember, if you remember, I think it was one of the clothing commercial lines, or maybe it was an Apple commercial where it had all the white, it was just the plain white background. So I said, that's what I want. I said, we're going to do this straight onto the camera, no frills, no red, white, and blue, no picket fences, me looking at the camera. And this is, and I said, because I actually literally wrote the first word.
Hey, me again, Michael Steele. Soon your TV will be jammed with negative ads from the Washington crowd. Grainy pictures and spooky music saying Steele hates puppies. And worse, for the record, I love puppies.
And I got to the point where I said, they'll even say I hate puppies. And they showed me with the puppy, and it took off. It was, I guess, groundbreaking in the sense that here you have this candidate looking directly at the camera and just telling people what he thought and what he felt.
Wait a second. That wasn't your dog?
No, that wasn't my dog.
Oh. Was it tough to be around puppies knowing that you hated them and had to pretend that you liked puppies? Like, you're
right. Do you even own a dog?
I do. I have a Siberian Husky.
And you didn't want to bring your dog on?
I didn't have him at the time.
Oh, okay.
I didn't have a dog at the time.
You immediately went and bought a dog after the ad.
No, actually. I never claimed that puppy was mine. I just said
misleading.
Why is it misleading?
It looked like it was your dog.
They checked his credit records. Dog purchases.
Yeah, there was no dog purchase.
Right. if you run into a friend who has a puppy, you go up to him and you pet the puppy, right? You don't claim ownership of the dog.
All right. How many takes was that?
That we did that in 3.
Wow. And the dog obliged.
The dog was great. The dog was actually better than I was.
the dog
was great.
So that ad comes out. The summer goes on. The polls kind of show a tight race. It was really tough to tell how it was going to go.
Right.
At what point did you sense it slip away?
I'll be honest with you. I never sensed it slipping away. There was not a moment where I felt, damn, we're not going to win this. I have a pretty acute antenna for that kind of thing, given the number of campaigns. I ran for comptroller in 98, got my clock cleaned. I ran, helped run other campaigns, and we've gotten our clocks cleaned. So I know what losing feels like. There was not a moment where I thought, we're not going to win this. We can't win this. I always felt that we would be in this thing. Look, I got sitting Democrats in Prince George's County to endorse me for the United States Senate. That to me was a very powerful, unprecedented moment in Maryland politics. For as partisan as Maryland is, you know, Maryland is one of the most partisan states in the country, where party matters to a lot of people. And yet you had elected officials in office endorsing me because of what I had been doing and where I wanted to go. And they knew I wasn't going to be that kind of person in the Senate.
But surely it must have felt that different outside forces were weighing you down. I mean, Bush, the Iraq War, but also I want to just touch on one specific policy which seemed to dominate your campaign, and I forget about it. People forget about this now because it was long ago. It was stem cell research.
Yes. That was very powerful undercurrent within the campaign, because I'm pro-life, and the Dems felt that they had a hook. And I've battled this pro-life question from the very beginning, and I'm unabashedly proud of my policy view and my position on this, both from a policy and a moral perspective. The difference between me and a lot of folks is I'm not going to beat you up over it. I'm not going to criticize you or condemn you for it. But they thought that they could use that as a hook. So what they did was they got Michael J. Fox, of whom I'm a huge fan, and that was a little bit of a sting, to be honest, to see the Michael J. Fox, because I so admired him. He was the Republican's Republican on television.
A tax is a terrible, hairy, liberal monster.
Family Ties back in the 80s as a young man. I mean, we're contemporaries, so we were, you know, young men together. I'm kind of watching and relating to him, and he's out there sort of saying, and as a character, I get it. It's not necessarily his personal view, but it just felt, you just felt a nexus. So when he runs the ad, I'm like, damn, really? You got to go there? So I was like, all right, fine, I'll up you one. I'll have my sister, who has MS, respond. And she did, with perhaps one of the most beautiful ads that I certainly saw in that cycle.
There's something you should know about Michael Steele. He does support stem cell research, and he cares deeply for those who suffer from disease. How do I know? I'm Michael Steele's little sister.
After that, they pulled the Michael J. ad because all of a sudden, this, again, tells you about the arrogance of the other side. They thought they knew me. They thought they knew stuff about me. They thought they knew my family. They didn't know my sister was, A, a doctor, pediatrician, B, suffers MS, and that by some weird, freaky family thing that we would actually talk about this stuff and have an understanding of where each other's were on the issue.
Yeah.
And so, as my sister said in the ad, Michael Steele would never do anything that would harm me. So you know he's not going to do anything to harm you.
Yeah.
You know? And so, boom, took it down. That sort of right in the moment, that was the other thing. It was sort of an internal battle because, again, the establishment types that I brought into the campaign were afraid to take that head on.
Yeah.
They didn't want to go, well, you know, Lieutenant Governor, I don't think you need, if we don't say anything, you know, Michael J. Fox is a big national figure. He's Hollywood. They put a lot of money. I'm like, let's take this son of a bitch on. You're not going to sit there and let this sit out there and have this define my position on stem cell.
What was the first moment in the campaign where you were like, why did I fucking do this?
probably 15 minutes after I said, okay. it's like, oh, this is going to be a shit storm, I know. But there were many moments like that. There were many.
Tell us a few.
Well, I think, you know, certainly dealing with the race stuff was a moment. Dealing with my sister... the whole stem cell issue, as you noted, Sam, was something that continued to be a thread that kept coming back, recurring. When it started to affect my family in a way, where they were kind of brought into it, there was all the noise about, you know, my sister holding a fundraiser. There was noise about, you know, the nature of the campaign and what we were doing. And, you know, everybody just kind of peeling back the onion and trying to find something. Yeah, you ask yourself, why are you doing this? And if you stay stuck on that, then you wind up running a very bad campaign because you're always chasing that rabbit.
Tell us a story about... Well, two stories. First, mm-hmm. Let's do the Michael Steele or Steele Democrat bumper sticker. It's time to admit it.
It is the most ludicrous thing I've ever heard. I was laughing my patootie off when I hear Democrats complaining about, oh, he's hiding from being Republican. I was like, how stupid do you sound?
These are bumper stickers that said Steele.
Steele Democrat, which to me was kind of cute because it's Steele. And Steele sometimes sounds like still. So you're still a Democrat, but you're a Steele Democrat. But this was the key thing for me. Had you never heard of Reagan Democrats? Why all of a sudden, well, now that I'm saying Steele Democrats, that somehow this has now transformed the political landscape? All I did was borrow from Ronald Reagan, who had Democrats who supported him. Remember, I had been endorsed by Democrats. So it only stood to reason to have a bumper sticker that said, hey, I'm a Steele Democrat. But the Democrats knew, and this was the underlying, they knew the power of that. They knew what that said to those Democrats that they wanted to keep corralled in a particular space to not look beyond what BS they had been doing.
Are you saying you weren't trying to necessarily present yourself to voters?
No.
Maybe...
How? Why? I'm a sitting Republican lieutenant governor. How do I hide from that?
I think he's right. It seemed obvious to me what he was trying to do.
I guess I have to contest this.
Why are you contesting that?
Because then what happened was the issue of...
This podcast is taking a turn.
This is the most contentious podcast we've ever had. Because then what happened was there was the ballot issue, or the sample ballot in which you and Governor Ehrlich were listed on a sample Democratic ballot.
That wasn't my campaign. That came from the governor's reelection team.
Right, tell the story from your perspective of that sample ballot, because that was like the end controversy.
Yeah, there was a a group that had put together a sample ballot that had been signed off by the governor's team. But again, the sample ballot was just that, a sample ballot. So it listed every candidate, every Republican candidate on the ballot. All right. So that was why I call it a sample ballot. But the way it was put together and what was left off and what was included became controversial for a lot of the Democrats. Look, the Democrats needed a hook. They needed something because they were losing this race. They were losing the race for the Senate. They were losing the race for reelection. So, again, go into the bag and pull out whatever you can and throw it on the wall to see whatever sticks.
But this allegation is actually true, though. I mean, they did bring people in.
Yeah, but again,
an erroneous ballot.
Yeah, that may be. But again, I only talk to my campaign because I ran a federal campaign, not a state campaign. They listed, you know, the ballot. I was on the ballot, so yes, I was.
So just to give the listeners an understanding, as I understand it, people were brought in from out of state, poor people, some homeless, to hand out ballots that said
nothing Democrats hadn't done before.
No, I'm not saying that. That the ballots were listed sample Democratic ballot.
But that was the reaction. See, well, Democrats did. That's okay.
I'm not saying it's okay.
I'm just saying. But
I want to just make sure I have the facts.
Who are you accusing specifically, sir?
So, but the problem people had was not twofold. One was that they thought it was a misleading ballot because it seemed to label you and Governor Ehrlich as Democrats. But the second thing was that there was homeless people who were handing them out.
And they do that in Baltimore. It's called walk-around money in the streets of Baltimore and Philly and everywhere else in the country.
Yeah.
So, hello.
So you thought that that the controversy was overblown, basically.
Of course it was, because it was more to score the political point. They needed something to tear down the governor in my campaign. And so this was the hook. But at the end of the day, what my argument back to folks, why are you acting like you've never seen this done in politics before? What, have you never heard of Chicago? Have you never heard of Philly? Have you never heard of Baltimore? Mm-hmm. How do you think the Democrats were electing folks all these years and getting their candidate, even through primaries? I mean, it's part of the process. It's an ugly part of it, but it's a part of the process.
Democrats don't pay people to hand out ballots. They pay people to vote, right? I'm fucking with you.
They do both. Going into the last weekend when the last polling was done, this was a 47-47, 45-43. You know, it was a very close race. There was about a 6% undecided that broke for the Democrats. It didn't break for Cardin, as you know, because OG Cardin was all that in a bag of chips. It broke for the Democrat. It broke anti-Bush. Bush had become a weight around the campaigns across the country, not just mine, and that was part of it. As we've seen play out in recent times, in recent elections with President Obama, Democrats not necessarily running headlong. Oh yes, we're all with the president in health care, creating that distance as much as they possibly can because they know down ballot there is a drag that occurs. And you know, down ballot and this is as one voter put it to me, Bush was not on the ballot, and I could only take out my anger on those who were. And that summed up the 2006 election.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I felt so lucky. But I told McConnell a few months afterwards, I said, "You're the luckiest SOB on the planet." He goes, "Why?" Because McConnell was a godfather to me in that race. He really did a lot to help me and was very, very supportive.
Like what?
Oh, aside from the obvious, he put on fundraisers and introduced me to folks around the country. Just his counsel. And he would call from time to time. Because McConnell is McConnell and I'm me. And it's like oil and vinegar or water. And but it works. They're good together, but it works. He would, tell me from time to time, "Well, you know, Michael, I don't know if that's exactly how you should say that or if that's exactly what you should do." He would always say to me, though, the one thing, he would always begin it in the conversation, "How much money have you raised?" Because he understood that in this race, I would need those resources to stay in the game. And he was very helpful there. But I remember saying to him afterwards, I said, "Look, you're the luckiest SOB on the planet." He goes, "Why?" I said, "Because if I had won this race, I guarantee you every week you'd be calling my office, 'Has anyone seen Senator Steele? Could you ask him to come see me, please?'" It's like the kid being called to the principal office, because The hill needs to be shaken.
I mean, I have to jump in with this quote, which made me giggle, to be honest with you. When you said, the hood is going to show up on the hill, said Mr. Steele, they label you a black Republican, because that's what articles had to label you.
Mm-hmm.
And then it said, this is what cracked me up. He said he delivered a similar message to Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist. And I can't, I was just imagining you talking to Bill Frist, telling him the hood's going to show up.
The hood's going to show up. I'm bringing 8th Street, baby.
He's going to be like, excuse me.
Excuse me?
What do you mean?
What do you mean by hood? What is this, like over the oven? What exactly are you talking about?
Hey, Jason here. Before we head into the next section, we need to give you a little bit of Steele's biography. Steele was raised in Petworth in Washington, D.C., and a graduate of Archbishop Carroll High School. He was lucky enough to be mentored by some of D.C.'s Democratic political elite. But a critical moment for him, at least politically, came in 1978 when he volunteered for Marion Barry's first mayoral campaign. What advice did Marion Barry give you over the years? Or did you guys talk when you ran for Senate?
The first campaign I worked on was his election in 1978 when he ran for mayor, which was a defining moment for the city of Washington. The best period, 78 to 82, for the city when Marion, before the demons took over and a whole lot of things started to go, really focused everybody's attention on the city. You saw the use of black power in a way that was authentic, good, and had good results.
This is a people's movement. Old people, young people, poor people, all of whom live in the 3rd District. And it's not fair for these citizens who are gathered out here today to deliberately be left out of the picture.
The one thing he taught me, though, was never forget the people. Because at the end of the day, that's why you're here. You're here for them. You can go to all the cocktail parties you want, but if you don't take time to go into Southeast, if you don't leave that cocktail party in Georgetown and take your butt over into Southeast and spend some time with real folks, then you will have missed the opportunity. And that, for me, was the driving message of why my focus has always been grassroots, has always been on a bottom-up solution. Because real people who live out life every day, they know how to balance the budget. They know how to make the ends meet. They know how to educate their kids. They know how to run their businesses. And the people at the top have forgotten how to listen to them. Mm. And for me, it's a matter of elevating that voice up and making people pay attention to that.
My only last question is there anything that you regret doing from the race?
Yeah. When I look back on it, we took one thing for granted, which we shouldn't have, and that was the vote in my home county. Despite the fact that we had, and Wayne Curry, God rest him, was the county executive at the time, had retired. But we talked about that, and the regret was that after I had worked very hard to get. And there were a lot of 6:30 a.m. meetings that I went to with a group of business owners and political leaders in the county. And it was a real struggle because the life issue for some of them was a big deal. They did not want to endorse someone who was pro-life.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to talk to them about my view on that and how I saw that in the context of being a U.S. senator, how I saw that in the context of my responsibility to the county. And brought them along. So there was a lot of hard work there. And we get this endorsement, and we failed to work it. We took it for granted. We thought by having these 5 black Democrat leaders endorse me that everything else would kind of fall into place afterwards. And we focused on Baltimore because Baltimore was the difficult nut to crack. And I spent a lot of time in Baltimore long before I had run for office and long before certainly I decided to run for Senate and had relationships there that we were really nurturing, trying to build. And we did the best a candidate, Republican candidate, even to this day, has ever done in the city in terms of the turnout of the vote that we got. But the lesson should be never forget home.
Mm-hmm.
Because we took for granted what home would do. and home didn't turn out the way by the numbers we thought, because the folks at home were equally, if not more, afraid of a Bush senator than the folks in Baltimore, than the folks in Baltimore County, than the folks elsewhere. And so I regret not paying attention, closer attention to my peeps.
Which is what Marion Barry had told you to do.
Which is what Marion Barry had told me to do.
That was Michael Steele, former Senate candidate and RNC chairman, all-around good guy, who sat down with us for what I honestly believe was a really candid interview. A big thanks, as always, to Christine Canetta, who puts up with our bullshit. You can find Candidate Confessional on iTunes or thehuffingtonpost.com. Please, please, please subscribe. Tell your friends. Next week, we bring you a YouTube legend. Well, a legend for all the wrong reasons. Ben Cunott, mayoral candidate of Toledo, who famously, mercilessly was booed in his run for office.
Wait.
Yes,
go on, Jason. Sam, before we leave, we have to share one last moment we had with Steele.
Okay.
After our interview was over, we played him a sketch from Comedy Central's Key and Peele on a meeting of black Republicans where they all look the same.
We are not a monolith. Mm-hmm. Democrats may be cool, but they ain't practical.
There you go.
Republicans are practical. Black people are practical. Come to think of it, I think black Republicans are pretty cool. Mm. Not to mention very diverse.
Excuse me, gentlemen. Sorry to interrupt. Someone's white wife is here to pick them up.
Okay.
What's her name,
Emily? Well, yeah, which I always found interesting because that was actually an issue during the campaign about my wife, who is fair-skinned.
Okay.
And a radio station in Baltimore chastising me for being married to a white woman.
Shut up.
Kid you not. And, I would remember going on the program and saying, okay, so all I have to say is you need to say that to my wife's face and you'll find out just how black she is when she whips your ass. And they were like, oh, my God, we're so sorry. We didn't know. I said, well, you speak to an ongoing historical issue within the black community itself, how we even define ourselves down in the black community, you know, between those with good hair, bad hair, light skin, dark skin. It's all bullshit.
Was there something to their joke about it being, you know, we're not a monolith and everyone?
I love that part because everybody would look the same, sound the same, and actually had to reemphasize we're not a monolith. So, but, you know, I get it. And we're not a monolith. And so I just wanted to set the record straight.